ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This is a 14-day reprieve for the community. I just think people need to understand what we've gone through, and drastic decisions such as curfews and the Chief Minister calling emergencies don't just happen after one incident. This is a back-to-back-to-back several months and years of destruction and damage in our community.
Alice Springs has had its first night of youth curfew that was declared following violence in the town's CBD. We'll get reaction from the community soon. And ageing town halls are still central to many regional communities, but the responsibility for them is not always clear. We head to one South Australian community worried about the future of its town hall.
People do like want to come around to towns and have a look at the history, the heritage, learn about it. It'd be a shame to lose all that, and that's the thing, you do keep losing that history.
I'm Alex Hyman and this is Australia Wide. We start in Alice Springs, where yesterday a snap two-week youth curfew was declared for the town's CBD in response to extreme violence earlier this week. The measures were put in place after violent fighting on Tuesday involving around 150 people. This was following the funeral for an 18-year-old man who died in an allegedly stolen car. Territory Chief Minister Eva Lawler described the widespread unrest as an emergency. The curfew applies to youth under 18 years of age and will be effective from 6pm through to 6am for 14 days, though the Chief Minister has said that could be extended if needed. More than 50 additional police and liquor inspectors are also being deployed to the town. Alice Springs reporter Lara Stimson compiled this reaction from members of the Alice Springs community.
The incidents that we saw over the last day or so, that was truly the final straw for this community.
It's a decision that we shouldn't celebrate, but we should welcome the decision, and hopefully over the next 14 days the tensity that we're feeling is removed.
I'm in Alice Springs today to catch up with stakeholders, but to meet with also the people of Alice Springs, to have conversations with the people of Alice Springs. The decision yesterday was made quickly. It was based on sound legal advice, but it gives me the opportunity today to meet with a range of people in Alice Springs to have the conversation, to talk to them about what the curfew means for them.
If you're a young person coming into the CBD to work, you can still do that. If you're a family and you've got young kids coming to have dinner in the CBD, you can still do that. You can go about your lawful business. It's about the unlawful conduct and the crimes that we're trying to control and put those measures in place under the provisions of the Emergency Management Act.
You know, just from talking to family and stuff like that, and just from myself anyway, it's bringing a lot of shame into town. And I think it's been long overdue now that, we start building some sort of relations in regards to working with police and with community for community safety.
Are you happy with the curfew? Do you think it's a good move?
I think it's a good thing. I think it's a good thing because it's about educating too. So, you know, it might have just happened last night, but it's going to go for the next 2 weeks. You know, a bit more media, a bit more information out there in social media and so on. And, with pollies getting on and police getting out there and a bit more numbers out there as well, I think it's all about education too. Educating people that, you know, enough's enough.
I think it's a band-aid. This is the issue, Brashy. So I respect the fact that some people think it's going to bring a level of calm, but it's not resourced properly. We're hearing on the ground that our police are unsure what their powers are and what they're allowed to do and not allowed to do. We're also hearing from your community that people are worried that it's going to push crime out into the suburbs because it's not dealing with the issue. Mm. So
should the curfew then, Leif Nockhower, should the curfew then be extended for the whole of the town then?
Well, then how do you resource that? We've got over 50 police coming from Darwin into Alice Springs. They're going to be in your town only for a couple of weeks. It's an unsustainable model, and that's what I'm saying. It doesn't provide long-term relief, which is what your community is looking for.
I think it's probably required and a bit of a shame. It seems like something that has built up over time. And the reason I think it's a shame is that possibly there should have been preventative measures put in place years prior or interventions in place so that we didn't have to get to this extreme response. It's disappointing, but I do think it's needed for the town.
Yeah. What do you make of this decision?
I think it's quite a good decision at the moment, just because we've had several issues over the past 5-6 months that we've been here, and it's better to regulate over the night time. At the moment, it's not been really safe for anyone to go out after 6 p.m. and I work in hospitality as well, so I get like a lot of youth disrupting that and not being safe around our workplace as well.
14 days. I mean, to be honest, you don't solve decades of issues in 14 days, do we?
No, absolutely not. And I think this goes back to years and years of social policy, that we've made policy on the run, people from Canberra and Darwin not worried about unintended consequences of Alice Springs. However, we needed that short-term circuit breaker, and I think we've got it.
I know you've been in the media for the last 24 hours. You called for the federal takeover of the Northern Territory yesterday. Are you still sitting with that sentiment, given what we've heard from the Chief Minister and police in the last 24 hours?
Look, I was critical of leadership, and I'd said if the government couldn't protect us, then they need to get out the way. And I think that the Chief Minister has responded in a way that we probably weren't expecting, but it's welcomed.
Some voices from Alice Springs responding to the snap youth curfew put in place yesterday for 14 days. We heard from Chief Minister Eva Lawler, Police Commissioner Michael Murphy, the Leader of the Opposition, Leah Finocchiaro, Mayor of Alice Springs, Matt Patterson, and Western Arunda Cultural Authority, Lee Abbott, as well as concerned locals in Alice Springs.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
And you are with me, Alex Hyman. It's great to have your company. Cancer patients living on South Australia's Limestone Coast say they deserve access to radiation treatment close to home. Many patients take the 10-hour round trip to and from Adelaide several times a month for treatment, separated from the home comforts and support systems. Despite this, a proposal to start a radiation treatment service in South Australia's largest regional centre has been knocked back for public funding. Sam Bradbrook has this story.
Mount Gambier woman Anelia Blackie knows one day she's going to have to sell her house, leave her hometown and move to a capital city. In 2020, Miss Blackie was diagnosed with uterine leiomyosarcoma, a rare cancer that starts in soft tissue and can spread quickly. The cancer is so rare, there's no chemotherapy drug developed yet. It means surgery and radiotherapy are the only treatment options. But there's no radiation treatment services in South Australia's second largest city.
There's all these systems in place, but what they do not consider is the emotional toll it takes on you with every visit and the anxiety that's involved in between all these appointments and leading up to it. Because when you know there's a tumour growing, say, for instance, on your spine or in your lung, you want it out as soon as possible. You want the treatment as soon as possible, but it takes forever, the whole process.
Mount Gambier is located about 430 kilometres from Adelaide on the Limestone Coast. For Miss Blackie, it means regular 5-hour drives while she has cancer clinging to her spine. She knows when her cancer becomes terminal, she'll need regular radiotherapy and will need to move to Adelaide.
Now, I'm living in a house that's mortgage-free. I'm on disability support pension, and it helps me to be able to afford, you know, all my expenses. But if you get to the point where you're terminal and then you have to relocate to Adelaide, you're going to have to pay rent or buy a new place or find some accommodation on a long-term basis. And you have to get rid of your pets. You have to, you know, make this big relocation, which is stressful in itself. But then as a sick person, to do that is really going to take its toll.
Miss Blackie is one of hundreds of locals who've signed a petition calling for a radiation treatment service to be established in Mount Gambier. Health company Icon have put forward plans for such a service before, but so far it's failed to attract public funding. Deanne Carmody is one of the leaders of a local group pushing for radiation treatment. In 2017, her 24-year-old son Scott was found to have a grapefruit-sized tumour on his brain. He wasn't expected to survive an emergency flight to Adelaide, but after surgery to remove it, he underwent 3 months of radiation therapy.
The whole point of this radiation therapy saga in Mount Gambier at the moment is not only the cost of it and the travelling and uprooting, but it's the psychological need for people that don't cope. They like Scott needed to have a special therapist to help him through emotionally because he was okay with his cancer. He was not okay not being at home.
Scott is still alive today, and an MRI last week showed his condition was stable. When the plans were knocked back for state funding in 2023, a report by the Limestone Coast Local Health Network Board found it wouldn't be sustainable. It found the region lacked the staff to safely operate it and the resources to manage the specialist equipment required. But a new feasibility study is now underway and it's expected to be done in July. Board Chair Grant King says the study will show if the service is now viable.
We do know, anecdotally at least, that some of the other centres that provide similar service have difficulty attracting clinicians and maintaining a stable workforce. And that's not only in cancer treatment, that's across a whole range of areas in health across Australia. So we want to be certain that the requirements to provide a safe, effective service here can be met, can be managed in a reliable and safe way.
Brian Hiphoff has an aggressive and advanced form of prostate cancer. He receives radiation therapy that's shorter but more intense than usual. It involves his head being fitted into a mask that's then bolted to a table so he can't move. Despite the invasive treatment he receives, the hardest part is being so far from his wife.
My wife couldn't travel up to Adelaide. She's not the best of health herself with her back. I was there for 2 weeks and, yeah, it was a bit of a struggle. My mother lived in Elizabeth, but I couldn't get out there to see her. I was fortunate enough to get into Greenhill Lodge, and I can't say how much I appreciate the people there, the work that they do for you. They're just so helpful. But the thing I found the most distressing was I didn't have my wife there to talk to. I didn't have my own bed. I didn't have my own creature comforts around me, even though it was a nice, comfortable room and everything. I was in a strange place.
It's not known how long it would take to establish radiation treatment in Mount Gambier. Mr. Hiphoff knows he may never get to use it, but he's fighting for those in the future and says decision makers need to take notice of the pain regional cancer patients go through.
Walk a mile in my shoes. See what I've gone through. Be in the same sort of situation and see how you feel. You can look at people and hear people say what's going on, but until it actually happens to you, you've got no idea.
That's Brian Hiphoff finishing that story by Sam Bradbrook.
You're listening to Australia Wide. On ABC Radio.
Town halls are a central feature of many towns and communities across the country. Some get regular use and are well maintained, whereas others have their glory days behind them. But even those somewhat neglected town halls still have history and the potential for a brighter future. But sometimes working out whose responsibility it is to look after these ageing buildings can be difficult. A community in South Australia's mid-north is dealing with the sale of its local town hall to a private buyer, due to more than $20,000 of backdated unpaid council rates from the deceased owners. Some community members say it's disappointing as they thought the council had taken ownership of the hall. But the local council says it is within their remit to sell the property that has outstanding council rates of more than 3 years. Port Pirie reporter Vicky Natafalis has looked into this and what other communities have been doing with their town halls.
Bruce Memorial Hall has sold for $26,000 at a public auction held by the Mount Remarkable District Council. The council has sold the hall on the grounds that it has accumulated more than $20,000 worth of unpaid council rates over more than 3 years. As the original five owners of the hall are all deceased, the rates are addressed to a descendant living in Port Augusta. Under Section 184 of the Local Government Act of South Australia 1999, a council can sell a private property that has outdated council rates of more than 3 years. The problem with this is that the community thought that the council had taken on the hall as a community asset in early 2000.
I know this council now is not responsible for what the council did, you know, 20-odd years ago, but there should be some record there of what should have been done by the council back then.
That's former Bruce local and current Corn resident Paula Osborne. She says the council has withdrawn the hall from sale two times in the past, first in 1999 and then again in early 2000.
From that moment, as far as the community knew, the council had taken ownership of the hall. The people whose title, the actual land title was in, decades ago passed away. And so they originally, you know, would have handed the hall, the land, as a community, you know, build the hall on it, you know, that's our land, we don't mind, sort of a thing. So we'd never really, you know, like, challenged anything because we always thought that the council owned it.
But Mount Remarkable District Council CEO, Sam Johnson, says the hall never left private hands.
That was certainly confirmed based on our own internal position and our legal opinion that the Bruce Hall was never owned by council. It was never officially transferred to council, hence why it was applicable under a Section 184 process.
Around 60 kilometres west of Bruce, the Port Augusta Town Hall has been repurposed into luxury accommodation. Building owner and property developer Jeevan Jute says heritage buildings often suit this type of conversion.
People like the feel of staying in a boutique, bespoke heritage building, provides a level of intimacy that a lot of generic office space can't provide in this conversion. So it's a bit of a wow factor there, a bit of a romance kind of thing.
Mr. Jute says a town hall is often an integral part of a regional community, and this hall is no exception.
The town hall is like a beating heart to a regional community, really. Obviously, it's not being used as a town hall anymore, but certainly a lot of people who, when we were doing the construction stuff, would come in and they'd tell stories about, you know, kissing the first girlfriend or whatever, or all these great hijinks that they had in the ballroom dancing and, you know, watching movies and whatever. So I think people have a strong connectivity to the building. I think it's would have been a disservice to the town had it been demolished.
But around 200 kilometres south of Bruce, in the Clare Valley, the Auburn Institute has been revived. Chair of the Auburn Community Development Committee, or ACDC, Rhonda Seymour, says that for a long time, the hall was run by a committee under the Clare and Gilbert Valley Council.
But there came a time when council wanted to relieve itself of some of those responsibilities and started talking to towns of different communities about taking on the ownership of their town halls. They started that conversation with ACDC in about 2014-15, and, well, things progress, the ceiling, you know, started to fall down. And, well, it eventuated that they granted us the money to do renovations and repairs and then gifted the hall to ACDC. We're thankful at the moment that it's back in community hands, and we would hope that our community is strong enough and passionate enough to keep it that way into the future.
Today, the Auburn Institute is run entirely by community volunteers. Tony Evans is chairperson of a subcommittee which reports to ACDC.
So it's set up in a very business-like fashion, and we have numerous events throughout the year to raise funds to ensure that we can keep the doors open. It's for the community, run by the community, for the community's benefit.
Former Bruce local, Paula Osborne, says she hopes at the very least the Bruce Memorial Hall stays standing.
People do, like, want to come around to towns and have a look at the history, the heritage, learn about it. It'd be a shame to lose all that, and that's the thing. You do keep losing that history. If someone came in and bought it and made a little B&B out of it, whatever they want to do with it, well, that's probably fine. But as long as they still maintain, you know, the history, they still maintain it, it's probably the shell. It's probably, you know, your thing that you really do want to maintain. It's not heritage listed, no, but I think it's still important to the history of the town.
Vicky Natafalis with that story.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
And finally here on Australia Wide, after mounting frustration in sharing his land with the Japanese energy giant, WA farmer Keith Tunney temporarily locked his farm gates late last week. For about 24 hours, Mitsui Exploration and Production Australia contracted workers couldn't access wells on Mr. Tunney's property, which is about 300 kilometres north of Perth. Geraldton reporter Joe Prendergast has the story.
They had like 30-odd vehicles, trucks, light vehicles, everything, driving straight past my sheds for the last 40-odd days.
Twice a day?
All day. All day and all night when they were running 24/7. The road they go past is within 100 metres of my house, and with these easterlies, it's been fun for the mile and a half with the dust that goes over our sheds and through our house and over everything. And when I asked them to grade the roads, we're going to do it afterwards. You know, can you do, you know, the noise, the lights? Oh, yeah, no, we'll be finished shortly. There's no reciprocation in, I'm a great believer in karma. What goes around comes around, but it seems to be a one-way street with this company.
Keith Tunney has shared his farmland near Dongara on the West Australian coast with oil and gas companies for 28 years. In that time, he's seen the 14 wells on his property change hands a number of times. But he says he's had enough of feeling ignored by the latest owners, Mitsui E&P Australia.
When they started 40-odd days ago, this was a big Christmas tree. And they were going 24 hours a day, and it was a bit of a novelty. My house is just over there, and you can see the lights from the veranda, and you could hear them going all night.
Mining and farming coexist through land access agreements. These dictate compensation and the obligations of both parties in sharing space. Mitsui has land use agreements to work on the wells on Keith Tunney's farmland, but he says some of those were negotiated about 60 years ago, long before he owned the land. The tipping point in Keith Tunney's frustration came when well workers kept driving through his property to access wells which were on neighbouring properties. So he locked his gates.
If something happened, one of my workers or my partner should get any sort of altercation with any of these vehicles, who's, what's, where, there's, you know, it's a grey area. And I've requested a meeting with them. Find out if we can come to some sort of conclusion, amicable conclusion, and they seem to be brushing me off.
And you've locked the gate?
Hence, I locked the front gate, and that's why this is all quiet at the moment.
What was that like when you decided, right, I'm going to lock them out?
Very nervous.
Why?
Well, they're a big bully. They're a big company. I'm only a little, basically, hobby farmer. They can take me to court and they can do anything they wanted with me. But they know that. Come and talk to us. Communicate. You know, be part of the community. You know, this is Irwin Shire. Don't rape and pillage. Put something back into the community talk and work with us.
Keith Tunney is paid between $800 and $5,000 a year for each well. Mitsui Exploration and Production Australia says it has land use agreements with all landowners where its assets are located. It says it's aware of a partner landowner raising concerns associated with decommissioning work, and the company says it has met with them. Mitsui also says it has traffic and dust management plans in place and aims to complete its decommissioning work in a safe and timely manner. Increasing amounts of landowners are being requested to share their space with mining and energy companies. Tim Hayter is a lawyer. He says farmers really need to get independent advice before agreeing to share their farmland.
It's always best to have independent legal advice from a lawyer with experience in this area. And from my experience, most of the mining companies, wind farm operators, will agree to cover the legal costs of the farmer. So if that can be negotiated and built into the agreement, then the farmer's not going to be out of pocket for legal costs. They're going into the agreement with their eyes wide open, and hopefully their interests are being properly protected and covered in the agreement. The agreements presented to the farmer initially are almost always prepared by lawyers acting for the mining company or wind farm operator. So that means they're heavily in favour of the mining company. You've got to remember the mining companies, the wind farm operators, etc., they're in there for commercial gain, so they're not going to offer top dollar with their first offer.
But do landowners have a choice? Can they simply refuse to share their space? Well, under WA legislation, mining and gas companies have a right to access freehold and leasehold land, but the companies must negotiate access agreements. The rules are different at the moment for prospective wind farm projects. Farmers can refuse to have them on their land, but Tim Hayter believes that will probably change.
The government can see the commercial interests in allowing access to land subject to compensation being payable as agreed or determined by a court.
That's Tim Hayter from WA-based Midwest Lawyers, ending that report from Joe Prendergast in Geraldton. And that is Australia Wide for this week. I'm Alex Hyman. I'll be back again with you next week. Have a wonderful Easter long weekend. Looking forward to your company next week. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.